Good morning. I was asked to be the discussant on both of these studies, but I want to, in a sense, start with a larger context. There's been a long-term interest in counting how much elder abuse goes on and figuring out how to do that. And I would argue, in fact, there's been a half-century interest in this particular regard. It goes back, in a sense, to the earliest national discussions on elder abuse, and those happened in 1960 at the Arden House Conference on Aging, where there was a concern about older adults that might potentially either neglect or be subjected to exploitation and a desire to develop protective care to deal with them. But there was recognition at that time that nobody knew how many such individuals there were out there. A quarter century later, at the first Elder Abuse Research Forum, which was held at the University of New Hampshire in 1986, people lamented that they still didn't know. Not just that they didn't know how much elder abuse went on, but they didn't know a lot of other things, and they didn't know how to get there in terms of methodology. And finally, more recently, in 2003, at the National Research Council's panel to review risk and prevalence in elder abuse, and this is the report that came out, and this is what has kind of propelled studies like this as well as other studies, there was acknowledgement that there was insufficient information about the occurrence of elder abuse across all kinds of settings that older people might be found in. Now, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been prevalence studies that have been accomplished. And the earliest, in fact, occurred in 1979 in Maryland, and it was done by Marilyn Block and Jan Sennett. They sent out letters to a random sample of older adults in that state, sent out over 400 letters, and they got back 73 responses and came up with a prevalence rate looking at four different kinds of elder abuse of 4.1%. The classic example of prevalence studies in the best regarded has been that done by Carl Pilmer and David Finkelhor, published in 1988, looking at the metropolitan Boston area, random sample study again, 2020 older people who were investigated, looking at three different forms of elder abuse and a prevalence rate of 3.2%. And finally, this one has already been referenced much more recently, published in 2008. Edward Laumann and his associates had a nationally representative sample looking at just three elder abuse forms, with the highest rate going towards emotional abuse at 9%. Throughout this entire period, there's been recognition about research limitations in coming to grips with frequency of the problem. There's been concerns about definitions, a lack of a nationally accepted standard in terms of definitions, all kinds of concerns about what are the recognized forms of elder abuse. There's been an acknowledgement about flaws in research design, as well as ethical questions on even how to conduct this type of research, especially with cognitively impaired older people. And finally, there's been acknowledgement of all kinds of sampling inadequacies, from very small samples to very biased samples. Now, this isn't to discount the fact that it's really important to figure out prevalence. And it's important for at least three reasons, one of which was acknowledged by Carrie just a moment ago. And that is, somehow you cannot interest legislators in terms of public policy unless somehow you show that it's a very big problem. They're not going to be interested in public policy around impacting this problem unless it's a sizable in terms of impacting older people. It's also unlikely you're going to get the deployment of resources, either from government agencies or other organizations, unless a number of people are impacted. And I'll give you an example in terms of my own state of Ohio. On two different occasions historically, we have lost all of our funding for adult protective services, and all of those dollars have gone to child protective services because we couldn't sufficiently show a large number of older people being affected by the problem. And we're likely to encounter this again this year. And finally, you only grab media attention and therefore increase public awareness about a problem if you can show it's either so rare, so unusual, or so horrific, which of course many instances of elder abuse are, or if you can show it's a really a big thing and therefore deserving of media attention. Now, even if we know the prevalence of elder abuse, it's not going to answer all the questions that are out there. It's not going to tell us the underlying ideology of the problem. And if we don't know why elder abuse occurs, we aren't going to know how to either prevent the occurrence of this problem or its reoccurrence. Knowing the prevalence of elder abuse is not going to tell us anything about the consequences of abuse affliction. It's not going to tell us the suffering, the injury, the disability encountered by elder abuse victims, and it's not going to tell us the cost to society of having this problem in our midst, the cost of health care and other sorts of things. And finally, knowing the prevalence of elder abuse is not going to be helpful in telling us effective detection and interventions. It's not going to tell us what works and what doesn't work in trying to impact the problem. That said, I want to talk just a little bit about each of these two studies, beginning with KINS. I think KINS is a very important study in terms of getting at how do you define certain elder abuse forms. And obviously in this case, it's financial exploitation, and although he didn't discuss it, psychological abuse. Because what's so important about the work that he has done is that he really begins to ferret out the dimensions, in detail, the dimensions of this problem. And he does it using rather sophisticated research designs and techniques for analysis. One of the things that has been desired in the field of elder abuse for a couple decades now is to get individuals who are researchers who are already established and perhaps concerned with other areas of research, get them into the field of elder abuse so that they can make a contribution to this field using techniques, using research methodologies that have been found useful in other subject areas. And clearly, this is what Ken has been able to do in his particular work with respect to financial exploitation and psychological abuse. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some issues with respect to this particular study. And I've just identified a couple of them, and a lot of them to me have to do with the sampling issues with respect to the clients. For example, probably not the best interviewers with respect to the clients in a situation like this are the Adult Protective Service investigators. There's a lot of potential bias in that particular regard. Also, in terms of the client population of 227 individuals, 61% were African Americans. In the general population of older people in this country, it's less than 9%. That's a very heavy bias with respect to one racial grouping. On the other hand, that particular racial grouping, African Americans, have been shown in a number of other studies to be particularly attuned to the problem of financial exploitation, be particularly concerned about it, and having more experienced it than other racial groups. And finally, in terms of the concept of substantiated financial exploitation and psychological abuse, staff marked it as substantiated even when there was only some indication of it, which would have to do with signs or symptoms or that kind of thing, and as we all know, that might necessarily deal with other things and not elder abuse. There were a number of conclusions that are interesting. Obviously, I can only highlight on a couple of them, but let me do that. Among the different findings that come out of Kin's studies is the fact that the structure of the client data represents a much simpler picture of financial exploitation than did the data coming out of experts. And I would suggest that's to be expected, that experts always look at the detail, at the richness of something because it's their work, it's their area of concern. And the classic example I can think of in that regard, my first master's degree happens to be in anthropology. And so the classic example in using those anthropological perspectives is, I come from the snow belt of Ohio, so I'm very familiar with snow. On average, we get about 105 inches a year. But I only know about three different words for snow, only about three different variations, so to speak, whereas Eskimos supposedly know more than 40 because they're the experts. It's a matter of their survival. It's a matter of their life. Another conclusion that comes out of this study is that the clients saw coercion is more severe and abuse of trust is less severe than the experts. And I would say that that's to be expected as well. Clients have a complicated and long-term relationship with their perpetrators. And therefore, the concept of abuse of trust would be less compelling to them than coercion. And let me give you a concrete example. If I have my adult son go out to the store for me, and I give him a $20 bill to buy me a loaf of bread, and he comes back with a loaf of bread, but doesn't come back with the change because he's used all that change to buy lottery tickets for himself, I'm going to be sad and I'm going to be disappointed. But we have the kind of relationship, to be truthful, that I realize that it's more than just that particular incident. On the other hand, if he coerced me out of the $20, it would be such a violation of my perceived rights as an individual. It would be such a violation of my self-determination that I would be very much concerned. Let me go to Ron's study. Ron's is really important for a couple reasons. First of all, it is the largest nationally representative study that has taken place with respect to elder abuse. The one by Lauman and his associates had as a sample 3,005 individuals. And here we have Ron, who has exceeded his own expectations of targeting 4,000 by getting 5,777 in his sample. In addition, he looks at more elder abuse forms than any of the other prevalence studies have done. The third reason this is so important is Ron has a history of looking, using this kind of methodology, at younger abuse populations or younger populations overall. And what's nice about having now done it with an older population is you can begin to do comparisons across age groups. And using Martha Stewart's, it's a very good thing. That doesn't mean that there might be some issues. And let me just give you one example of that. I had some concern about how he defines certain sorts of things that seem to be kind of representative of the population as a whole. He terms low high household income as under $35,000 a year, and yet that represents nearly the majority of the individuals in this representative sample. He terms very low levels of social support, and yet, again, this is nearly the majority of the individuals in his sample. There are a number of conclusions of interest. First of all, as you saw on the slide when he was coming to an end of his presentation, approximately 1 in 10 individuals who are community-dwelling older adults had experienced some form of elder abuse in the past year, and of course it increases to 1 out of 7 if you include financial exploitation. Generally speaking, before this study, people would use a kind of range of elder abuse occurrence between 2 and 10%. So what we're finding out with Ron's study is it's beyond expectations in the past. And in fact, it's really at the upper limits of those expectations. And it almost harkens back to the earliest research on protective services going back 40 years, where they came up with the number of people that might be needing a protective intervention as somewhere between 15 and 20%. So it's much more of that caliber. The second thing he found was low levels of social support correlated across almost all elder abuse forms. I would suggest that low levels of social support, lack of social support, social isolation have been recognized as salient risk factors for abuse occurrence for over 20 years now and have been found to be true in a number of studies. What's particularly interesting in this regard, however, is that we are seeing lower levels of individual social support among Americans overall, and this has been going on over the last 20 years. A study done in 1985 found that the typical American had 3 close friends. More recent studies are finding it's 2 close friends. Well, you have only to look to the future in terms of our aging society to wonder the implications of that for the future of elder abuse. Another finding on Ryan's part was that emotional, physical, and sexual abuse have a kind of perpetrator profile that includes high unemployment, increased substance abuse, increased likelihood of mental health problems, and social isolation. There, too, there's been a number of studies going back 20 years that have found this to be almost the classic profile of the elder abuse perpetrator. And my own research included in that regard. And I would suggest that Ron's absolutely right. With this kind of a profile, there are things that can be done in terms of rehabilitative, social, and other services to deal with this, to prevent occurrence, to prevent reoccurrence. And yet I was surprised then when Ron came up with the following concluding statement, and he did, I don't know, I saw it in your slide, but you did in the, what you had sent me.
Yeah, I took it.
Okay. And what it said was, and I'll quote, "Unfortunately, most of the mistreatment probably would not qualify for criminal justice prosecution under most current statutes. This factuality is disappointing and speaks to a social acceptance of abusive behavior." Well, I would argue that elder abuse has been conceived in such broad terms that there's not going to be any single intervention, criminal prosecution or otherwise, that's going to be able to deal with all forms of elder abuse. Rather, criminal prosecution will be one of many that needs to deal with it. And elements like certain forms of neglect, certain forms of violation of rights can be dealt with in other channels through other means.